WVW Broadcast Network and The New American are pleased to present The New American Television. This program is dedicated to bringing you the truth behind the news.
Welcome to The New American TV, where we bring you the truth behind the news. Today's Friday, June 9th, and I'm your host, Paul Dragoo. Today we're discussing the origins and evolution of the LGBTQ tyranny in America. Straight America has been asleep on a deadly battlefield with a relentless enemy that is waging total war. Investigative journalist William Jasper wrote those words in the June 8, 1998 issue of the New American magazine. The title of the article was Queering of America. He also wrote that the homosexual revolution is but the latest and most viscerally repellent installment in an ongoing, much larger revolution that has been in the process of upending our entire civilization for many years. Other authors who had written in that issue, titled The Politics of Perversion, warned that the homosexual army was marching to achieve more than just tolerance. Those tolerant citizens who think that, hey, I'm not gay, but they're not harming me, have a rude awakening coming, Jasper wrote. We warn that militant organized homosexuality would demand complete approval, special privileges, and will use government power to further its objectives. We warn they demanded pro-homosexual courses in schools, federal funding for its organizations, complete acceptance in the military, the repeal of laws governing the age of consent, and changes in marriage laws. Father James Thornton, one of the authors, said that, quote, militant homosexuality is a huge wrecking ball designed to demolish the foundations of our religion and families and our nation and civilization, end quote. 2 years after that issue came out, President Bill Clinton designated the month of June as Gay and Lesbian Pride Month, which is fitting considering what a degenerate he was. And 25 years after our warnings, the LGBTQ army has accomplished all but one of the objectives we predicted, the one regarding the age of consent, which, by the way, is still being targeted. The LGBTQ lobby has had huge success. Since 2000, the Supreme Court has decreed so-called gay marriage legally equal to legitimate marriage. A number of Americans have been financially ruined because they refuse to go beyond tolerance to celebration of the homosexual lifestyle. Gay entertainment is inescapable. Gay ideology indoctrinates children in government schools from coast to coast. Gays, bis, and trans occupy some of the most powerful positions in government. People who publicly oppose homosexuality have been fired. And even the CIA, the world's preeminent intelligence agencies, is celebrating Pride Month. In 2023, June is simply known as Pride Month. And the LGBTQ lobby, which is probably adding another letter to its acronym of perversion as we speak, is more in your face, more militant, more perverse, more powerful than it's ever been. But it's still not satisfied. This week, we reported that the Human Rights Campaign declared a state of emergency for LGBTQ people. But how could that be, considering the smashing success these people have had? This is especially impressive given how small a segment of the population they comprise. Well, it turns out that the Human Rights Campaign views legislation that aims to stop child mutilation in the name of gender-affirming care and ban pornography from K-12 government schools as an attack on LGBTQ people. Oh yeah, we forgot to mention that. Just in recent years, this lobby of perversion inflamed its sickness up a few degrees. The LGBTQ movement now works to groom children, mutilate children in the name of transgenderism, and saturate government school libraries with pornography. So how did we arrive at such an insane point? This is a country where the very first European colonies were essentially Christian church communities. Well, according to Dr. Paul Cameron in his book, The Gay 90s, if you want to pinpoint the beginnings of the U.S. sexual revolution, you might well choose 1921. That was the year the National Research Council organized the Committee for Research in Problems of Sex. This group of philanthropists, physicians, and scientists felt an urgent demand for study of human sex behavior with all the resources of modern science. They believe that sexual behavior depends on biological and psychological factors and made no considerations of the spiritual component. The National Research Council and the Committee for Research in Problems of Sex began to fund studies using money from the federal government as well as the Rockefeller Foundation, go figure, projects that lay the groundwork for a completely scientific view of sexual behavior. So I'm joined by my colleagues, TNA Senior Editor William F. Jasper and TNA Executive Senior Editor Steve Bonta. Welcome, gentlemen.
Pleasure being here.
It's nice to have you in the studio, Bill.
Yes, yes, in person.
Yes. So obviously I cited quite a bit from an issue that you almost single-handedly wrote in 1998. So I wanted to start off, with a question. I think a lot of people are wondering this. Is like, this is such a small, such a small segment of the population, yet they have amassed such power. How has that happened?
Well, you hit on it very, very well in your introduction toward the end there, where you pointed out about the National Research Council. So this began a century ago, and without the support of the big foundations, Rockefeller Foundation and the Ford Foundation, and of course in more recent years you have the MacArthur Foundation and many other philanthropic foundations, tax-exempt foundations, that have poured millions of dollars, and by now probably billions of dollars, into all of the universities, all of these study groups, and of course all of these militant NGOs, the organizations that are doing it. So this is not a bottom-up, natural
movement,
grassroots movement. It is a top-down funded, organized effort to completely overturn American society, Christian society. And we focused a great deal on the admissions against interest on this, actually the boasts by the militant homosexual lobby in their program, their book in the 1990s called After the Ball. Mm-hmm. And we can dive into that as we go along.
Yeah.
Can I just interject? I think we need to be careful assuming that it's still a really, really small percentage.
Oh, yeah.
Because the whole point behind all of this aggressive advocacy and the grooming and everything else is that the homosexuals know that it's possible to turn people, quote unquote.
Yeah.
It is. And a large number of people, I don't know the statistics, but a large number of people who end up, becoming homosexual, practicing homosexuality, had some, were victims of some sort of sexual abuse when they were children and so forth.
Yeah.
And so they do know that if you similarly abuse other children, that you can encourage that. And we also have the pretty clear evidence from other cultures, non-Western cultures, including, of course, the evidence of the story of Sodom and Gomorrah from the Bible, that it's possible for this sort of thing to become completely institutionalized, normalized, and accepted. And, in many non- and pre-Christian cultures, what we would consider the abuse of children in Sparta, for example, was institutionalized, and so in a sense you could say that the level of homosexuality came nearly 100%. In that context, it is ipso facto impossible to sustain Judeo-Christian civilization.
Yeah.
Well, that's a very important point.
You touch on recruitment.
Right, and so the first statement I referred to at the beginning, in the 1920s, 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s, even during the 1960s, among the SDS radicals, the Students for Democratic Society communists, homosexuality was viewed as a perversion. And it wasn't until after that in the 70s and then in the 80s and then in the 90s when it was really promoted extensively in the popular culture that more of America became acculturated to it, became used to it, and it now has become much more a culture-wide phenomenon.
Now, can you go into that a little bit? Because back to the recruiting aspect, they do intend and they work to recruit, right? Would you connect that with the grooming that we're seeing now for the, you know, the in the more even more perverse aspect of their agenda? But they do recruit, right?
Like, well,
they
absolutely talk about it out loud. This was denied by the homosexual lobby vigorously. In 1983, 84, I think it was 83, the International Gay Lesbian Alliance, ILGA, had NAMBLA, the North American Man-Boy Love Association, and
they
other...
They still exist, don't they? NAMBLA?
They still exist, and other pederasty, pedophile groups. And that was kind of a... was a big point of contention amongst them. Some of the ILGA militant homosexual lobby said, well, that's just too... That's too over the top. It's going to offend too many people. They weren't really opposed to it, but they said it's kind of going against our trend to make us more family friendly, etc. So we have to deny that we groom children, that we're recruiting children, and they tried to some of them tried to eject NAMBLA from ILGA, and NAMBLA refused to resign, and so it came down to a battle at their world conference, and NAMBLA stayed in. And so the homosexual movement tried to just play it down and keep NAMBLA and the other pedophile groups, like the Rene Goyon Society and others, off to the side and claim, well, they don't really represent us. But as homosexuality in general has become more acceptable, then they started bringing in the drag culture and now we have the Drag Queen Story Hour, the transgender movement, which is specifically targeting children.
We're going to get back to that, but let's stay. I think this would be a perfect opportunity to talk about the Alfred Kinsey studies, that because we're talking about the number, you know, what is I don't know if you guys know what segment of the population is bi or gay or whatever, but that 10% number that is actually cited, that was of warped studies, correct?
Right. So, there was a dear friend of mine, a wonderful lady, crusader, Judith Reisman. She wrote several books on Alfred Kinsey. She made that her focus of attention, Dr. Reisman. And this book, Kinsey, Crimes and Consequences, was one of her best. And she really delved down into the Kinsey record. And Dr. Alfred Kinsey had received millions and millions of dollars from the Rockefeller Foundation and other foundations to promote perversion and to make it acceptable, not just homosexuality, but sexuality of all kinds, pansexuality, they called it. And his main claim to infamy, from our perspective, was his claim that children are sexual beings from birth. And so he said that there's nothing wrong with adults having sex with children. And of course, that was astounding, earth-shaking, and most people couldn't believe that. So he came up with studies that supposedly proved that this is normal in all cultures, and particularly in American society. And he cited all of these studies that he had done, but he didn't reveal his evidence. In the scientific field, and even the social scientific field, you have to reveal your sources of evidence. And it came out when she dug down into it, and why did it take decades for someone to challenge this? She dug down into it and pulled out that his subjects that he cited as representing a normal American population were prostitutes, women prostitutes, male prostitutes, convicted pedophiles. Many of them were still in prison, and he was surveying them and then presenting that as this is your average dad, uncle, husband, etc.
Yeah. Did you want to add anything to that, Steve?
Not particularly.
All right. Well, we're going to take a quick break, and then we'll be right back to finish this discussion. We're going to actually look at the psychological battle that's happening, that got us here. We'll be right back, folks.
In 1988, the John Birch Society produced a documentary so predictive, it's as though they had a time machine. Out of Control, Immigration Invasion was produced and hosted by investigative reporter William F. Jasper and looks at the growing problem of unrestricted illegal immigration that, in 1988, already saw upwards of 10 to 20 million illegal aliens within the borders of the U.S. Unknown agents from around the world using the southern border as easy entry. Certainly, some are innocent families escaping hardship, but also certainly some are criminals, potentially terrorists. Is it not appropriate that there be some criteria for the entry of any sovereign nation? Why should the U.S. be different than Canada, Germany, Russia, Japan, or every other country on the planet? Out of control. Immigration invasion. Watch this time capsule of prescient wisdom at thenewamerican.com/out of control.
Welcome back, folks. So we're discussing the origins and evolution of LGBTQ tyranny. Before we go on, I wanted to offer a disclaimer here. And I wanted everyone, our viewers and listeners, to know that no one in this organization hates or seeks to harm anyone who identifies in any of the various aspects of LGBTQ. And we certainly, we don't seek to strip anyone who identifies themselves as that either of any natural God-given rights. So I would imagine that you gentlemen agree. I don't know if you want to add anything to that, but this is not, we don't hate anyone, right?
Right. So this has been the dilemma though that we've faced. Anyone who opposes the militant homosexual agenda, including the recruitment of children, the grooming of children, the abuse of children, is portrayed as a hater. And that is part of the agenda we can get into. They explicitly, Madsen and Kirk, in their book, which served as the manual for the homosexual agenda for the past couple of decades, said we have to portray those who oppose us as haters. In fact, they even said we have to give images of slobbering, Bible-thumping haters to the public so that the public will be repelled by that and will be more likely to move over into sympathy with us. And so, no, we believe in the axiom, love the sinner, hate the sin. So just as with any other pathological activity, whether it's prostitution, drug addiction, whatever, we're opposed to it. We don't hate the sinner. Yep. We'd like to see them reform their lives.
Absolutely. Do you want to add anything to that, Steve?
Well, just to point out that, excuse me, that kind of works both ways. We also would respectfully request those on the other side to understand where we're coming from. I think that overall, this, you know, because of the very nature of homosexuality in its various manifestations, lesbianism and so forth and so on, most people who aren't of that persuasion find those acts to be difficult to comprehend or perhaps even downright repellent or something like that. And so people assume that that equates to hatred. And this is part of the reason also that the other side has consistently adopted language and terminology, like the word gay, which when I was a boy, I'm old enough to remember when gay was still used, it was a nice word.
It was happy.
Yeah, it meant happy. It usually, you can see this in movies up through the 1960s, people talk about, you know, these gay surroundings, meaning kind of a nice festive environment.
We had a gay old time.
Sure, a gay old time. These types of phrases were very positive. And so, you know, this word, which apparently started as part of sort of underworld slang way back in the 1930s, was consciously seized upon and used as, you know, to make it seem like something glamorous, something positive. The term happy was also briefly used back in the 1970s as well as slang and other things like this. So, you know, you have this problem that on the one hand, there are any number of offensive pejorative words that shouldn't be used in polite company that people use. Mm-hmm. And then the other hand, there are these exaggerated and equally, you know, unrealistic, you know, positive descriptives You know, and as far as I'm concerned, I mean, probably the best thing is to refer to these things as homosexuality and so forth, which are the clinical terms yeah. that have been used since time immemorial to describe these types of behaviors.
Okay. Well, let's go into the psychological warfare. And you cite it after the ball, and you use a lot of that research. There's a quote in there where it talks about how they seek to desensitize the American people. And it says, you can forget about trying up front to persuade folks that homosexuality is a good thing. But if you can get them to think that it's just another thing, meriting no more than a shrug of the shoulders, then your battle for legal and social rights is virtually won. I'd say they have succeeded wonderfully.
And to clarify, those were not my words. Those were the words of Hunter Madsen and Marshall, Hunter Madsen and Marshall Kirk. They were the two homosexual authors, psychologists, Madison Avenue promoters who set out most explicitly the agenda for transforming the American mind and the American attitude toward homosexuality. And yes, they said we have to desensitize the public by, first of all, and you may have some of those quotes there, he says we're going to saturate the American public with gayness. He says we'll have all kinds of stories that are positive of people coming out. It's so important for them to have stories about coming out of the closet. And they pointed out that we're going to be able to do this through the media because we have so many sympathizers in the mainstream media and in Hollywood, and how we would use entertainment and the media to acclimate the American mind to this, that even if we don't get a positive response from everybody, said we want to get them to the shoulder shrug stage, they just go, oh well.
And obviously we're far beyond that now.
Yes.
We're far beyond that now. There, there are, you know, the agenda now is you know, you need to embrace this. You need to love us. You need to put us at the forefront of your cultural pantheon. Mm-hmm. You know, far beyond mere tolerance now.
Oh, right. It's so they want to wear, and we could cite many examples of this, in corporate America and in the government. When Hillary Clinton was Secretary of State, issued a directive that if someone comes out in your office in the Department of State, it is not acceptable to remain silent. In other words, you have to show approval. You have to show affirmation, which gets to the, if you're silent, that's a thought crime. You are internally not accepting this person, and that's a microaggression because they may feel offended because you haven't affirmed.
What they say now, silence is complicity. They say that with the BLM people say that too, right?
Yes. Yeah, so this is psychological warfare, and people are succumbing to it because they're now in woke corporate America, your jobs may depend on it because the new ESG standards require that you affirm perversion.
You mentioned corporate America. You know, now people have awakened because of the trans madness, and Disney has become a main target. Interestingly, in your research, in 1998, Disney was already there. Can you go into that a little bit?
Not just Disney, but Hollywood has been there from the beginning. I mean, if you go back to the 1940s, there was a very prominent Hollywood star named Cary Grant, who is, as an actor, I think he's one of the greatest actors ever. But it was well known in Hollywood circles that he was bisexual. And so if you watch Cary Grant films, there are a large number of them, Bringing Up Baby and, My Favorite Wife, to name just two, where they contrive to get him into drag somewhere in the film for comedic effect. Because everyone, except his co-star Irene Dunne in the one movie, who was apparently hopelessly naive, but everybody else kind of knew, and this is an inside joke. So, and a number of other, you know, I mean, for example, the movie My Favorite Wife, which came out in 1941, I think, that was where Cary Grant met Randolph Scott. And the two of them forged a relationship that lasted for decades. Everyone in Hollywood knew about it. And, you know, many, many other, you know. So in a certain stratum of society, this kind of thing has always been acceptable.
Mm-hmm.
Usually the
sub rosa, not
oh,
public.
Oh, sure, sub rosa. Yeah. I mean, Oscar Wilde, for example, in the 1920s slang, according to H.L. Mencken, the term wild man was slang for homosexual because he was out of the closet way back more than 100 years ago. In the 19th century, you know, the famous American philosopher Charles Sanders Peirce, one of his older brothers, was homosexual and was a strong advocate for homosexuality in the Eastern establishment intellectual, you know, Harvard, Yale circuit. So this isn't a new thing, even in Western civilization.
And the homosexual lobby, their academic branch, has gone back, and now we have all the gay studies at all major universities, LGBTQ, LMNOP departments, and they are dredging up all of this stuff to show that, see, this is normal. This is, and we know that all pathological, sinful activity has had a normalcy among a certain population throughout all of human history. But civilizations that survive and thrive are those who repress and discourage that kind of behavior, vice, and exalt virtue. And what we've seen now for the past several decades is an intensified effort to reverse all of that, to inverse that, to perversely turn that upside down and turn vice into virtue. And so now, during the Clinton administration, it was the first time that our federal government began affirmatively hiring those that previously we would associate with vice. In other words, it was a plus on your vita if you were out as a homosexual. And so the Clinton administration began doing that. But even preceding him, George Bush Sr. was the first one to do the Revolutionary Act, which was praised by all the homosexual organizations when he brought a whole group of homosexual militant leaders to the White House for the signing of the hate crimes legislation.
And it bears mentioning that Donald Trump was not a break in that chain because he, you know, our ambassador to Germany was openly homosexual. And even more to the point, we have now in the so-called conservative movement a number of people who are very prominent, celebrated conservatives who admittedly, you know, don't rub it in your face and they're not out there participating in the gay pride parades, but they're also, you know, out of the closet. And so it's become mainstreamed to an incredible, I mean, you know, if you want to talk about psychological warfare, I think one of the most subtle but powerful elements is the inclusion of this little single letter, Q. What does Q mean?
Is it queer?
It means questioning.
Questioning. Yeah.
Oh. So does that place it's queer and some, it's questioning, meaning, oh, am I or am I not?
Well, but the thing is,
oh, they're already opening their arms out.
Oh, sure. No, what they're trying to say, and they don't necessarily mean, you know, tormented souls who are in the throes of early adolescence who haven't quite figured out what their sexual identity is. They mean, if you look at their writings, if you've ever been in the gym and seen some other guy who's all jacked up, boy, that guy's got a really impressive physique. You might be questioning that type of thing.
They want everyone.
Absolutely. And so you see in movies for the last 20 years, little references to this, you know, which for comedic effect, where some guy will, you know, like you see the scene where they say, oh, boy, you know, she's really got an impressive. And then the other guy will say, oh, yeah, I agree. And you realize he's talking about the man or something like that little thing. And this is all to promote the idea.
I wonder if that would include, it's like growing up, it's like, you know, we lifted weights and whatnot. Oh, and it's like we had Arnold's poster.
Sure, well, that's what they will say. This is a deep homoerotic tendency that you should really not suppress. And you should look at it and see, maybe this indicates that you truly are homosexual. So, but to then get back to what you originally said about Disney, this is what the reason I opened the story with that was because at that time in the 1990s, Disney was still associated with the quintessence of child-friendly, family-friendly entertainment and wholesomeness. I opened with a quote from Elizabeth Birch, who is head of the Human Rights Campaign, who was telling a vast audience of the LGBTQ, LMNOP activists that corporate America had opened up to her and the Human Rights Court. They'd been working closely with top Fortune 500 companies, and foremost among those was the Disney Corporation. And she said she was introducing or was speaking with Michael Eisner, who was then the CEO of Disney. And she said, well, you know, Michael, 30% of your Disney employees, your artists, et cetera, are homosexual. And he said, oh, no, it's 40%. And so he was very much boasting clear back at that time that, hey, we at Disney, we're way out in front of all this. So that was a really a very profound indication of how dreadfully this has had already permeated and penetrated the major corporations. Because that was,
decades
ago. And Disney was not as innocent as all that, even decades ago. I mean, these many of you have seen the videos and the stuff, the various takes of these sly little phallic images that they managed to insert into, you know, everything.
And
from
he meant,
And more recently, I mean, the one that really got me was in the movie Frozen, which was such a big thing a few years ago. And there's a clear, I didn't notice it watching the movie, but this point out later, there's actually this very quick scene where a door opens and in another room, you see a very muscular, completely naked guy frolicking in a hot tub with two little kids.
Oh, wow.
Very clear what the message is.
I think we need a break.
Yeah.
Well. All right. We'll be right back, folks.
As a lumberjack, I've been cutting wood for decades. My job is pretty straightforward. I see the wood, I chop the wood. My axe goes through every time. You remember when everyone bought all the toilet paper? And they wanted me to wear these things? And someone invested a lot of money into this stuff. They say I'm part of a global plan. I don't think so. It's too hot, it's too cold. You know what? The weather changes. We even hear crazy ideas on how kids should learn.
Here's the news, Dad.
Is it, son? Is it?
What about this one, Dad?
Nope. It's hard to tell what's real and what's fake these days. There's just too much baloney out there. At the New American, they cut through the baloney and give me the truth.
Visit thenewamerican.com and subscribe to get 50% off the cover price. And if you want an even better deal, use the promo code 10OFFSUB. Again, that's 10OFFSUB for more than 50% off.
Welcome back. We've been discussing the origins and the evolution of LGBTQ tyranny. I have with me Bill Jasper and Steve Bonta, part of the editorial staff here at The New American. Gentlemen, it's been very great, educational anyway. So I want to continue, and there's we've been talking about this issue that we did in 1998, of which you wrote a large portion of, but also Father James Thornton, who I understand may have been on the staff at the time as well, he wrote a great article on it. And one of the things, I wanted to quote something that he said, and he said something to the effect that this homosexuality, this perversion radiates moral anarchy that presages the chains of despotism. And I found that very interesting because he's saying there is a correlation between sexual perversion and totalitarianism. I don't know if most people would think of that, but why do you guys take it away? I mean, what do you think of that?
Well, he was restating an eternal principle that philosophers throughout the ages and specifically our founding fathers enunciated many times. I mean, George Washington, John Adams, all of the early founding fathers pointed out that a just government, a limited republic like ours, can only exist among a moral people. You have to have chains on your own passions, that is, you respect other people's property, other people's rights, and respect your own God-given characteristics. And if you don't, your passions will forge your chains. And it's a very important thing for us to realize that we can have a government of freedom and limited government only if we limit those inclinations that would then cause chaos and end up bringing about it.
So those who have a discipline over their sexual urges are likely to exhibit some aspect of that in civic life, which then, you know, creates
absolutely a
freer society. What do you think, Steve?
Well, first of all, people will be ruled. They'll either be ruled by God or they'll be ruled by tyrants. And we know that homosexuality is a contravention of the laws of God. So, like other forms of sin, particularly more egregious types of sin, you know, living that lifestyle amounts to open and, you know, and continuous repudiation of God. That's a fact. Again, that sounds very stark and even harsh.
That's so judgmental, Steve.
It sounds judgmental, but it's borne out abundantly by, you know, by the record of the scriptures. But let's look at it another way. All societies, and certainly all civilizations, depend crucially on one fundamental building block, and that is the family.
Mm-hmm.
All right? And until, you know, very recently, it was inconceivable that, you know, with, you know, absent modern technology, it's impossible to even pretend to turn a man into a woman, although Nero tried to have it done with one of his favorite slave boys. So, you know, even things like so-called sex, what used to be called sex change operations, are not a new thing under the sun. But
they have obviously become
the idea that really doesn't matter. You know, men can become pregnant, so can women. The roles of mother and father are archaic and out of date. Is patently absurd on the face of it, and the idea, well, gender is one thing and sex is another, and let's separate those out. One is the biological, and the other is that's absolute errant nonsense. Okay,
yeah.
Gender and sex may be technically different manifestations of the same thing, but God does not make mistakes. He doesn't put a female spirit into a male body or vice versa.
Yeah.
Now, that said, it's clear that, you know, like with other things, this is something some people have an inclination for, or a weakness for, just as some people have a weakness for gambling or alcoholism or indeed, you know,
fornication
and adultery. I mean, they're all kinds of things. And why we single out this particular transgressive behavior and say, this needs to be exalted and sanctified, while still probably much more puritanically than in the Clinton era, insisting on these very, very rigid norms of decorum as far as behavior between men and women. You know, you because otherwise, you know, sexual harassment now is very defined, you know, and all these types of things. So in some ways, we've become more puritanical about that, at least superficially. But at the same time, we say, you know, but somehow where homosexuality is concerned, it's a free for all. There are no standards. I don't understand the contradiction.
Well, and speaking of that, it's known the promiscuity in the homosexual, bi, whatever, trans community is non-debatable.
Like, sure, I mean, it's off the charts. In my article there, clear back in the 90s, I quote Larry Kramer, who was the famous playwright, homosexual, most people would consider him promiscuous. And he had a very fiery diatribe against his queer community at that time, saying, look, this is crazy. This is suicidal. There seems to be no limit to the furor sexualis. He says you engage in all kinds of filthy activity. He said, and without relentlessly, without any kind of let up or any restraint. And so he says you might even have the
accusation. I have it. Well, there's some. Well, Dr. Paul Cameron, he talks about homosexual males are 14 times more likely to have syphilis. Homosexuals are 8 times more likely to have hepatitis, 3 times more likely to have other sexually transmitted diseases like gonorrhea. And then there's rectal infections and trauma. And I like this. Well, I don't like it, but I think it's poignant. The anus and rectum are not sexual organs. They are the drain pipe of the body's sewer. Anyone foolish enough to play in a sewer can expect unhealthy consequences. And that was in the context of health problems that doctors had been seeing among the homosexual community.
Right.
And also the age, the expectancy age as far as living is tremendously lower among the homosexual community.
Right.
And when you get into the trans, the people who actually sexually mutilate themselves and change their gender, the suicide rate is what, 40%?
Right.
And it's absolutely phenomenal.
And it doesn't so the go argument down afterwards. Like
right.
They
so
claim.
The argument for it was that, well, this is gender affirming to do the mutilation, the surgery, so that they will feel whole, so that they will not commit suicide because these kids are suicidal. Well, the suicide rate goes up after they have the transgender operations and all of that. So, it's incredible that we have allowed this to happen, where children are now being mutilated, and you can't undo it once this is done. And it's totally unethical, criminal on the part of those doctors and counselors.
Well, let me ask you something, though. At the time when you were reporting on this, I mean, you had quite a few, you had a bunch of predictions here that turned out to be true. You know, they wanted to legalize marriage and adoption rights. I don't think that had happened yet. They wanted to. The only one that hadn't really happened is so far as the age of consent laws. And we're seeing that.
No. That is already under assault. We have now.
It's under assault. But
yes. And it has actually been changed all over the world and here in the United States. What we had is age of consent laws that were specifically targeted by Kinsey and by the Rockefeller Foundation back in the 20s, 30s, and 40s. At that time, it was age of consent between a man and a girl. Now it's man-boy.
Yeah.
And so now they call it minor affirmed attraction. So they are pushing that term, and they're saying, we don't want to have any of the pedophile or pederasty laws anymore. We want, so you designate, instead of pedophiles, they will be called minor attracted persons. And they're just simply attracted to minor persons, meaning children. And the children, they say, should have the ability to consent to these, because as Kinsey proved, they say, children are sexual beings from birth, and parents are oppressing them by not allowing them to express their sexuality. And that is why we have in the schools many of these things where the homosexual and lesbian teachers and transgender teachers are promoting this among the kids and say, don't tell your parents, don't tell your parents. And then when the parents show up at the school boards, then the FBI says, oh, these are
domestic terrorists. Before we go to a last break, I wanted to ask you, when you were writing this and you saw so much of this happening, not because you're a prof, because you saw the trends. It was, you had been reading the literature, you were seeing where this was happening.
I was watching it actually happen in Los Angeles, in Hollywood.
I was living there
and seeing how this was Los Angeles actually preceded San Francisco in terms of, they had the first gay pride parade in 1970. So they celebrated the 50th anniversary in 2020.
What I wanted to know, though, is did you see at that time that we would be in 2023 at a point where we have to fight to make sure that 13-year-olds aren't having their genitals cut off and that they're not being groomed and that there's no drag queens in fifth grade and third grade? Did you actually ever imagine it would get to this point?
Well, I had this discussion with my editor at the time, with Gary Benoit, and because much of what I was predicting was, he said, well, could that really happen here? And I said, yeah, and even worse. Now, I didn't know about the transgender operations, the mutilations that were coming. But in terms of what was going to be going on in the schools, which we see now, that was very evident because previous to this article, 1994, I believe, the National Education Association, the largest teachers union, had already issued their proclamation on this, saying that we had to have all of these homosexual affirmative programs in the schools. It had to be enculturated into the curriculum. And so we knew that this was coming, and it won't stop here. I mean, there are going even further. The next step is bestiality.
I was going to add, you really? I mean,
oh, yeah,
at this point,
that's where
this is
going.
Nothing's off the table.
Holy moly. All right, let's take a break. We'll be right back, folks.
Life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. The Declaration of Independence proclaims God-given rights, and we intend to protect them. Working with people like you for over 50 years, preserving freedom and building a better tomorrow. Safeguarding the Constitution by limiting government power. We are restoring liberties, educating voters, and leading the freedom movement. Join with us. United, we will defend our rights. We are all Americans. We are the John Birch Society.
Welcome back. So we've been talking about the evolution of LGBTQ tyranny. And before we dived into our last segment, one of the things I wanted to clarify is this, do you guys believe that this depravity that is being foisted on us, is this intentionally to destroy Western civilization and American civilization? We have touched on the Rockefellers, and we kind of touched on how this is being worked. It's not natural. It's not a grassroots movement. So are you saying that this is intentional for the exact purpose of destroying our civilization? Do you believe that?
Well, absolutely, on the part of many of the movers and shakers who are the key promoters of this whole perverse agenda. Obviously, many of the minions down below who are...
victims?
They are victims who are carrying out much of this. They're simply following their passions, but... The folks who are promoting this at the top, we've already mentioned the Rockefeller Foundation, the Ford Foundation, many of the other tax-exempt foundations that are promoting this, and the top media people that are promoting this, they know this is destroying our civilization. So you have the top globalists, and something we haven't gotten into, and it'd be a subject for another one, is the communist aspect, because the earliest efforts to promote the homosexual movement, the first real activist was Harry Hay, a member of the Communist Party, a top advocate on the West Coast. And he and the organizations that he formed at that time were promoting it from the leftist standpoint to get all of a cadre going that could promote this. And so he was kind of outside the Communist Party. He was inside the Communist Party, but even many of the communist leaders knew that this was a touchy topic, yeah, and they didn't want to be openly associated with
it. Well, if I could just add to that. So I think that we bandy about this term cultural Marxism, and it is worth spending a minute or two to just describe where that came from in brief. So originally, you know, the vision of Karl Marx was primarily this, I mean, it was a revolutionary vision based on this idea that we would have this economic and social, you know, this structure upheaval, and we'll be able to collectivize and do all that stuff that's contemplated in Capital and the Communist Manifesto and so forth. The early 20th century, starting in the city of Frankfurt, pretty much during and after World War I, a number of Western Marxist intellectuals came to the conclusion that whereas they were able to carry out a communist revolution successfully in a peasant society like China or the Russian Empire, in the well-educated Western European countries, let alone the United States, they needed to do something else to prepare the ground for that to take place, to basically de-educate people in the norms of their culture and their civilization. And that meant an active program of cultural de-Christianization, because they correctly perceived that it was Judeo-Christian morality
that was in the way, huh?
That was really the buttress with, you know, the traditional family structure and all this other stuff, that they needed to get rid of that. And so they really, along with Antony Gramsci, who was not really part of the Frankfurt School, but Gramsci on the one hand, who advocated the so-called long march through cultural institutions.
The Italian communist?
Yes, the Italian communist. And then the other hand, the so-called Frankfurt School, which thanks to World War II, ended up being transplanted to the United States. And people like Erich Fromm and Herbert Marcuse stayed and wrote effusively and prodigiously about the need to radically transform the culture. And that meant, you know, starting with the so-called free love movement in the 1960s, first normalizing sexual promiscuity and then normalizing every manner of sexual perversion. I mean, one could say without exaggeration that the homosexual, the normalization of homosexuality and the other kindred perversions that we've talked about in this show is the apotheosis of this cultural Marxist revolution. And the idea, the conscious goal behind many of these movers and shakers that Bill mentioned and others besides, is, and they do this with malice aforethought, to destroy our civilization so that then they can create a new civilization in its stead, which of course is a Marxist civilization, all that implies.
Yeah, I mean, so this is a perfect opportunity to go into, you know, if whether or not there's hope. We had talked about this plan to desensitize, but I think, and I don't know how you guys feel about this, but now it seems like they've hit a wall with this gender mutilation or this child mutilation, this trans craziness. We are seeing a lot of pushback. I would say more than maybe we're seeing in the 90s and 2000s. I don't know if you guys, I would think so. But so is there hope? Do you agree that we're seeing a wall, a pushback? And what's the answer here? Is there hope?
Well, yes, there is always hope, and but we're in a very desperate situation that we have allowed this to perversely penetrate throughout all of society. So now you're seeing, with regard to the transgender push, a very severe pushback. We see it with the libs of TikTok, where this gal who put up the libs of TikTok just basically shows the
how insane they are.
Actually bragging about how they're injecting this into the classrooms. And we see many, even Camille Paglia, the atheist, libertarian, lesbian feminist, she has come out very strongly against all of this, against the transgender. So a lot of people are beginning to really take severe umbrage with this. What we really need to see is all of the churches standing up. The churches have been neutralized to a large degree by political correctness. They don't want to appear to be judgmental, et cetera.
And that was part of the plan, right?
Yes.
Go to the progressive, the liberal churches.
Right. So
get them on board.
Hunter and Madsen and Marshall Kirk, in their book, After the Ball, specifically laid out. That's what we first, you go to the very progressive churches, the Unitarian and all the other mainstream churches that have gone left, and then you start working with the others. So now we have a lot of the evangelical churches, Catholic Church, et cetera, that have gone soft on this, or in some ways even supported. And so we need to have a recrudescence of the real faith in all of the churches, because this is existential.
Yeah.
Steve referred to Karl Marx. Karl Marx, in the Communist Manifesto and elsewhere, wrote about the need to destroy the family. And so this form of cultural Marxism, and then it went, now it's beyond Marxism, it's Marxism-Leninism, because Lenin took the theories of Marx and actually put organization behind it. And that's what we see now, the actual organized effort to destroy the family, destroy the faith, destroy our civilization. And it should be pointed out to those who are promoting this at the lower levels, who think that this is going to be some kind of nirvana once the American Republic is destroyed, that none of the communist countries allow the open operation of this perversion.
No, they don't. China not only doesn't, they're actively militant against it, but they're also complicit in encouraging it here,
right?
Because they understand very clearly it weakens, it debilitates our civilization to their advantage.
Right. So as with drugs, et cetera, the communist countries are intolerant of any drug use or any of the things that they're promoting
pumping it here, though.
They're pumping it here, right. So they use it as a weapon to destroy us because they know it will be very effective. It will dissolve the things that hold us together.
I wanted to finish off with this. I think some churches are picking it up. I know that the church that I attend, they have sexuality classes, and they have recognized what kind of crisis we are in. Obviously, we all wish the churches would have woken up earlier in the 90s when you're sounding the alarm bell and whatnot. But like you said, it's never too late, not as long as we're sitting here. So maybe I won't finish. I'll give Steve the last word. You got 20 seconds, Steve.
All right. Well, I think there is hope. And hope resides in the fact that, to some extent, perhaps the bad element is getting worse, but the good element is getting better, perhaps being tempered by the refiner's fire types, circumstances that we have. Unfortunately, that means that to some extent we're experiencing kind of a divergence culturally, into these two moieties of society that are mutually unable to tolerate the other.
Yeah.
So I don't know what that portends.
Yeah.
But I do think in the long run, as I've said multiple times, the Republic will endure. This is a severe trial that we're going through.
Thank you, gentlemen. Thank you. Well, that's all for our show today. Make sure to tune in on Monday as we take a deep look at the latest Trump indictment on espionage charges. In the meantime, for more Truth Behind the News, make sure to get a subscription to The New American Magazine. You can do so online at thenewamerican.com, or you can call our office at 800-727-8783 Monday through Friday from 8 to 5 Central Time. So have a good weekend, and we will see you Monday.
Imprisonment, forced labor, permanent separation from my family, perhaps death. I knew what could happen to people who were caught trying to defect, but the watchtowers stood yards away. The possibility of a new life in a different world, one without tyranny, was within sight. The West. I thought of the rewards no longer crushed under the boot of communism. I would work and make money, no longer restrained by the chains of collectivism. I would say what I wanted, without fear of spies and informants nearby. I would be free. The frozen rain and Romanian mud seeped through my gloves and cloths. I fantasized about a fire burning in the wood stove of my parents' home. But I pushed those thoughts from my mind, closed my eyes, and waited for the cover of the darkness.
Get Defector, a true story of tyranny, liberty, and purpose by Mark Hobovkovich with Paul Dragoo. A thrilling page-turner that will remind you how precious yet vulnerable freedom is. Available at shopjbs.org or Amazon. For a limited time, get 20% off your entire order using promo code DEFECTOR20 when you purchase DEFECTOR at shopjbs.org.